Welcome to the Commentary Magazine podcast. Today is Thursday, April 20th, 2017. I'm John Podhoretz, the editor of Commentary. With me, as always, Abe Greenwald, our senior editor. Hello, Abe.
Hello, John.
And Noah Rothman, our associate editor. Hi, Noah.
Hi, John.
Commentary Magazine, the 72-year-old monthly of intellectual probity, political analysis, cultural commentary from a conservative perspective. Join us at commentarymagazine.com. You get a few free reads. And then we ask you to subscribe for $19.95 for a digital subscription and $29.95 for an all-access subscription that gets you our beautiful monthly magazine in your mailbox 11 times a year. So it's almost monthly. It's still a monthly, but we have a double issue in July and August. Gentlemen, the news story of the day is, of course, the defenestration of Fox News Channel's Bill O'Reilly after a series of articles detailing allegations of sexual harassment and settlements with women accusing him of sexual harassment dating back 13, 14, 15 years. Thus, following the allegations of former Fox News anchor Gretchen Carlson about sexual harassment at the hands of Roger Ailes, the genius majordomo of the Fox News Channel, who was himself defenestrated last summer after a 20-year run as the most successful news channel manager and inventor in the annals of American history. So, not that that history is that long, because the cable news channel is itself only 35 years old as a construct, but nonetheless, creation of a multi-billion-dollar business. O'Reilly himself generated hundreds of millions of dollars in profit a year, or at least $100 million in profit a year for Fox, so that his the sacrifice of his career and his position was a painful one for Fox, unless you believe that the series of boycotts against him were going to be permanent, in which case his ability to earn money for the network would have been severely compromised over time. So, Noah, before you became a print journalist, you cut your teeth in the media business in radio. And what kinds of experiences? I'm going to talk a little about my knowledge of Fox, but I'm wondering how this resonates with you as somebody who has worked in this field.
Well, yeah, I mean, I don't really know, because I obviously didn't experience very much sexual harassment. It's a male-dominated industry, and the experience of a young man in that environment, in radio in particular — I didn't spend a lot of time in television, but in radio I did spend a fair bit of time. And there's a power dynamic there. There are hosts, executives, members who are higher up on the ladder who wield a certain amount of influence, and there's like a hazing that sort of goes on, but it's much less, compromising. Like, it's not something that you can't bear. Although I did witness quite a few people who were my peers, I suppose, coming through that process, who didn't respond very well to that dynamic and did leave as a result of it, because it is intimidating. But it's certainly not criminal, and it's not sexually harassing. So it's much more different for women. I can't speak to how women deal with that sort of situation. But the sort of animalistic dominance hierarchy that is established there is something that I did experience. It's probably very universal.
Abe Greenwald?
Well, it's interesting also, because in radio and in talk show television, or in sort of, news analysis television, often sort of verbal abuse is part of the entertainment. It's also things can get very blurry. If there's a personality who's sort of known to entertain by being obnoxious, that can obviously spill over.
Right. Well, there seem to be, classically in media, there are two types of obnoxious personalities. There is the weird phenomenon of the obnoxious on-air personality that, when the light goes off, when the on-air light goes off, turns into an extremely shy, retrocessive person. I mean, I've known people like this my entire career as a sort of dilettante in radio and television, that the sort of pit bull person emerges when the on-air light goes on and disappears the minute it goes off. It's a very strange phenomenon. That's not O'Reilly, by the way, but right. Go ahead.
But by all accounts, that's Howard Stern. I mean, I wouldn't know firsthand.
But others, but Sean Hannity, whom I've known for many years, and I don't think isn't really a pit bull on the air. I mean, that's not his, it's not that he's a lunger at people and a sort of person who is wildly confrontational. He likes to have on people who agree with him and they can have a grief fest, a love fest. But Sean is a lovely guy. He's very nice. He's extremely good to the people who work for him. You won't hear anyone who's ever worked for him who has a bad word to say about him. That's a very important quality, I think, in any kind of employer. And whatever it is, whatever difficulties and I have with Sean's behavior over the last year and a half and sort of selling his soul to Trump, none of that gets to anything about him as a human being, as an employer, as a boss, or anything like that. Bill O'Reilly is a pig. Bill O'Reilly is a pig on the air. Bill O'Reilly is a pig off the air. He is an unpleasant person. He is a nasty person. He is an unfriendly person. He is a solipsistic person. And I don't know anybody, I'm not sure I know anybody who particularly disagrees with this, a view of O'Reilly personally. I mean, it was universally thought at Fox. Now, here's my take on O'Reilly and Ailes and the regime of the sexual harassment culture that apparently we must now presume was part and parcel of Fox. There was nothing unusual about it in 1996 when Fox started. I started in professional media in 1982 at Time Magazine, a respectable, starchy, white collar, white shoe, waspy institution, not very little sort of scrappy coloration, very, somebody once said people at Time had their suspenders buttoned into suspenders in order to keep their pants up. But everybody drank and there was a lot of intramural sex, and the hierarchy in 1982 was almost an entirely male executive authority, and it was only in the 1970s. In the 1970s that women were allowed to write for the magazine. Women were otherwise researchers, desk. There was a total sort of sexual division, and the women were support staff, and the men were writers and editors. And this, there was a TV show about this. My sisters worked at Newsweek in the 1970s, and it was only like 7 or 8 years earlier that there had been a famous lawsuit at Newsweek where women took Newsweek to court on the grounds that they were denied fair access to promotions and won. And now, Times Magazine is an editor. There's no such, the notion that journalism itself, could have this kind of gender division is insane. Now that's print, but it was what Mad Men was. Everything was like the Mad Men culture you saw on television in the 60s was very prevalent. It was a lot of drinking, a lot of sex, a lot of men in superior positions and women in inferior positions, and a power dominance game. And part of what was expected of women, in my experience, was that they learn how to navigate it. Like, if there was a lech, they were supposed to let the lech know and know in certain terms that he wasn't supposed to touch them, and that, they would not be bullied, and then they would be respected if they did that. Or people, someone would say, oh my God, so-and-so, George just came on to me, and then the other person's supposed to go, what did you expect? Don't go into his office and let him close the door. What's the matter with you? By the mid-1980s, all of that was transitioning and changing with the advent of sexual harassment legislation, sexual harassment cases, sexual harassment training. But Roger Ailes obviously came from, he had been Mike Douglas's producer in the 1960s. He was a TV guy. He's funny. He's a very funny guy. He's a very kind of, cynical, corrupt, amused guy. Basically it's like, this is how the world works. This is how we do things. I'm not giving in to this liberal, politically correct culture we'll do things the way we do things. People want to see pretty girls on the air. They should wear short skirts because people want to see their legs. And in a culture like that, if that's the dominant idea about how you cast your on-air talent, of course it's going to leach into the way people behave off the air.
I can't speak to the behavior of Bill O'Reilly or how any of this impacted the work environment over there. What I can say is that there does seem to be sort of a shift, as you've noted, from like an earlier generation of the programming of this sort of cable news, for example, as like you would program a radio show, where very much you have a personality-based program, and the fans of that program are enticed and attracted to that personality. And we've slowly been getting more into content where individuals actually have to know a little bit about what they're talking about. But one of the, I read something about Bill O'Reilly's process, which has always frustrated me, that he, and I'm paraphrasing it because it was years ago, he would get in the car on the way to the studio where he would dictate talking points memo, having done no research, having read nothing, having no interest in the subject matter beyond what exists in his own head. And he would there, it would just dictate what he thought. And that would be how he approached topics. And that cheapens what we do for a living. And I always resented that. And also, it's, you know, it creates just a dynamic where the audience is interested only in your personality and not what you have to offer on the topic. And that's not how Megyn Kelly did her show. That's not how Tucker Carlson did his show. It's not how Sean does his show.
Abe, you know, that's interesting because, I mean, there was a time where I watched O'Reilly fairly regularly, not because he imparted any great wisdom or analysis, but what interested me in the show, and I think he was sort of saved by this, was its structure. The show was made up of these digestible little bits, like the talking point segment, like the Pinheads or Patriots, and they were very smart. He didn't have to know a whole lot because everything moved so quickly.
Well, and they invented the campaign, right? That was one of his things, was he would decide that there was a war on Christmas. Right. And he would do segment on War on Christmas. It was 4 minutes a day. He would do it for 100 days. It had a kind of cascading effect. So he knew how to deliver bite-sized chunks of outrage, of anti-PC outrage in some fashion.
That's how you do a morning talk radio show.
Right.
And it's extraordinarily successful. It's a model that hasn't changed in 30
years. But the thing about O'Reilly, and I say this as somebody who couldn't bear to watch his show and on it four or five times in the course of its run, and my experience was instructive because I was only called on times when I wrote something or other that Bill wanted to talk about because he had felt abused by whatever writer I was criticizing or op-ed writer. And so the thing about the show was that, as is true of all star vehicles on television, nonfiction star vehicles on television, it was about O'Reilly. Like someone once said, the thing you have to understand about Oprah, which is, I think, by leagues the most successful television program of all time in this regard, is that the show Oprah was about Oprah. It wasn't about the segments. It wasn't about the people she brought on. Once she had established herself, it was about Oprah's journey. Oprah's journey from being a sort of tabloid television fixture to becoming more positive, Oprah's weight loss, Oprah's gifts to her, to the people, you know, it was Oprah. It was about, and Oprah was a lot bigger star than anybody she had on as a star. It was a bigger personality and richer than any rich person she had on. And O'Reilly show was about O'Reilly. He was the biggest personality in cable television. He was the biggest star in cable television. He had the largest ratings in cable television. And it would be a mistake to say that O'Reilly show was about political correctness or it was about, you know, populism, or it was not. It was a psychobiography, a daily psychoautobiography of Bill O'Reilly. And a person like that, the solipsism that that promotes, a guy who had knocked around television news for 20 years, had been in 15 markets, had been a correspondent for CBS, the legal correspondent for CBS News, had gotten bounced, ended up on Inside Edition when it was the lowest of the low. It was sort of like below the National Enquirer as a television tabloid show. And then he and Ailes conceive of this program for this new fledgling channel, and it becomes this sensation. The point about him is that the culture of Fox was a culture in which political correctness did not hold sway. And so for a lot of us, what that means is we are not going to be held to shibboleths about how we can talk about things, because they're going to choke us off and make it impossible for us to deal seriously with the issues that confront the country. But for a lot of people, including, I think, the talent and stuff at the Fox News Channel who got wrapped up in this, and Donald Trump, saying you don't like PC is to say, what's the matter with having some fun with a few broads? What's the matter? I can't talk about your legs? Are you so sensitive? You're so sensitive you don't like it when I say you got nice legs? Or your figure? Or maybe you could stand to lose a few pounds? What? I can't say you could stand to lose a few pounds? You're a beautiful woman. Maybe you should get a haircut. Maybe you should wear a shorter skirt. But of course, that's nobody's business. I mean, it's somebody's business to some extent. I mean, it's a hypocrisy to say that people on television aren't supposed to look as good as they can and to promote some weird fantasies on the part of their audience. That's television. It's a visual medium.
Well, look, you're 100% right. I remember years ago, when did the Andrea Macris
So Andrea Macris was a producer for O'Reilly, and in 2004, word came down that there had been a settlement between O'Reilly and Macris had quit, and there had been some lawsuit, and there had been a settlement, and nobody knew the terms. And then 3 years after that, I think TMZ or The Smoking Gun or one of those websites got a hold of the settlement document, which is otherwise confidential. And it turned out that he had settled for a staggering amount of money, right? Like it was either $9 or $12 million for one person.
Right.
So that she had basically been paid off to buy her silence. And as I think somebody said, which I think is important, somebody in television said, I mean, that is not nuisance, go away nuisance money. Right. That is, you know, you make a calculation that Bill O'Reilly is so valuable that Fox should pay Andrea Macris $10 million to go away. And, you know, and that's going to cut into your bottom line for the year. And you really have to balance, you know, maybe I should let O'Reilly go and he'll have to deal with this, or we're going to pay her off and make her sign a non-disclosure and confidentiality agreement, and no one will ever know.
And the thing about it is, so what his when he addressed the Andrea Macris case on the air, his response was exactly along the lines that you described. I remember he said, well, look, I'm a loudmouth guy. I've always been a loudmouth Irish guy, and this is just the way I talk. And this is what do I go wrong sometimes? Yeah, but it's no big deal. You know, that was after, by the way, he went on The Tonight Show and said, I'm a victim. Celebrities are victims. It's been going on too long, and I'm going to fight it even if it costs me my career. And then a day or two later, Macris's side came out and said, we have tape of a phone call. And then he said, oh, okay, I'm not going to fight it.
Now, see, I don't think that I experienced anything, and my experience was limited, but it was anything remotely as toxic as that kind of environment. I do think this behavior is unique in a fashion to Bill O'Reilly. And,
well, that's
and people
important.
Like him,
right.
Albeit that's a generation ago.
If we're going to be honest, I think we have to acknowledge, and the world has to acknowledge, that it's not just going to be a conservative news channel in the media universe that creates these environments in which women are either mistreated or actively mistreated by their employers or their supervisors. The idea that there is an ideological component to this is slightly true. As I said, I think the PC, come on, you know, let's not, no bull crap here, you know, this is men and women, and, you know, let's be honest about what really goes on between men and women. Okay, so that line isn't convenient to, and is not sort of something that's promulgated in the corridors of a, you know, nice liberal left-wing news channel. But it is show business, and show business is a visual medium, and there are, you know, women being manhandled on casting couches in Hollywood, and there are other talk show hosts on television who misbehave toward women and behave piggishly toward women, and in fashions that will should trigger lawsuits and the same kind of accusations. Obviously, there is a degree of glee at the undoing of the Fox News Channel that has nothing to do with the desire to bring a true sense of justice to people who have been mistreated, but to kind of try to destroy Fox and kill its success with its viewership, which is not happening. I mean, we'll see what happens now, but, you know, there was this fact that Megyn Kelly left and Tucker Carlson came on, and Tucker Carlson outdid Megyn Kelly in the ratings, and now Tucker Carlson's going to shift into the O'Reilly slot. What if he gets exactly the same ratings or better than O'Reilly did? So it's going to turn out that it's Fox. It's all Fox. It wasn't O'Reilly, or maybe it was originally O'Reilly, but now it's just the Fox brand is so connected to this world of its viewership that there is nothing that will degrade it. And there is no competition. But as somebody, I think, funnily said on Twitter, imagine an Earth 2 where O'Reilly gets into trouble and he leaves Fox to be the headline performer on Trump TV. Everybody remember Trump TV? Hmm. The network Trump would start if he lost the election?
Which they actually made some moves toward.
Right.
There was a lot of reporting about that. They were preparing a soft landing for Trump if he lost.
Yeah, so just imagine that. Trump and O'Reilly at, you know, 8 and 9 p.m. respectively on Trump TV.
And this also gets into the question about what happens to O'Reilly from this point on, and we disagree a little bit about this. I mean, my take is I'm in a minority here generally.
Okay, so my take is he's done. He's finished. This is pretty much the last we're going to see of him, and here's why. Nobody else can hire him because after this, it would be a prima facie creation of what is called a hostile work environment, which is the trigger for sexual harassment action, either with human rights, local commissions on human rights at the state or local level, or employment law, or even civil rights law, depending on who you are. So if you as a person writing a contract, if you were MSNBC and you wanted to hire Bill O'Reilly or CNN, it would be a wild mistake to do so, because whatever money he would bring in, you would end up leeching out because of the hostile work environment creation that you would have done. So he can't go to any other network. So he's 67 years old. Is he going to start an internet business? I kind of doubt it. And so, basically he needs a major platform to work his will. This show is what he can do. This show and ghost-written books that somebody else writes and he plans his, you know, pastes his name on. Because he did 15 other things that didn't work. And what's more, during the run of this show, remember, he started a daily radio talk show that failed. Whereas Sean Hannity, who was half as successful as he on television, of course, was a sensation in talk radio. So O'Reilly is not a convertible talent. There may be nothing for O'Reilly but the O'Reilly factor. That's what I'm saying.
And I think that we live in an age where no one is done anymore unless they're in jail or dead. And I think he might launch perhaps an internet brand. I think in part because he is in the habit of fighting back. He hates when people get the best of him. That's as John says, his show has always been this psychobiography, and a huge part of that has been his fighting back against Al Franken or whomever is trying to nail him to the wall. I don't think he's going to take this lying down. I think he has enough money to launch his own venture. He has loyal viewership. He still has connections, including possibly still to the president. I don't think, sadly, we're going to hear the last of him.
I'm going to split the baby down the middle and say that he's going to write a lethargic, perfunctory martyrdom book, because his publisher is still with him, and he's going to try to absolve himself in that fashion And that'll probably be the end of that. I agree with John that he doesn't really have much of an impetus to create a media empire. But I do want to note real quick before we move on to another topic that, and just to brown nose a little bit and do some cross promotion on the Glop podcast, which you should listen to on Ricochet, your colleague Rob Long noted that you have to be number one before you can be number seven. And to trade entirely on your brand as a network is a losing proposition because your brand as a network doesn't really exist. It's entirely based on programming, and the programming keeps you at number one.
And of course, the programming was all the invention of Roger Ailes. Like, so one of the things here is that one of the replacement programs is they have to shift the format around, is the 5 moving to 9 p.m. The 5 was Ailes's creation of a panel discussion program at 5 p.m. To replace Glenn Beck when Beck became an advertiser at advertising sinkhole.
Which, by the way, was an adaptation of The View. It's not like
right.
that was invented.
But
that was extremely successful.
The story
in the cable
about Ailes is this, that when he assembled the panel for the 5, he brought them in and he said, each and every one of you, I have a replacement here at Fox if you give me any trouble. So the concept is the star. You're not the star, and you're not the star, and you're not the star. The concept is the star. This is where, you know, we don't know what happens to Fox in the absence of Ailes, really. I mean, so Tucker was a big hit. I mean, the thing is, of course, that everything in media now, in an odd way, is a big hit. There's this kind of wild new focus on everything because people are paying attention the way they haven't paid attention in a long time, really since after 9/11, because of the unexpected nature of the political developments of the last year. And so it's almost like Rachel Maddow has record ratings, and Chris Hayes has record ratings, and Anderson Cooper has record ratings, and Tucker Carlson has record ratings, and our subscriptions are up 25%, and National Review subscriptions are up 25%, and the New York Times is up 25%, and Stephen Colbert has had a surge, and Trevor Noah has had everybody, there's a new connection to everything, whereas everybody was sort of drifting off away, you know, into their screens and their games on, you know, Angry Birds on their phone, and then kind of snap back into general interest with anything relating to the news. Who knows how long that lasts? I mean, maybe it'll last forever, maybe it won't. But I will tell you one thing, which is that our friends at Ricochet, who are helping us promote Commentary Magazine, we are going to talk to you about their sponsor and ours, SimpliSafe. SimpliSafe is a security system that you can order online, and when you do so, you take the first easy step to protecting your home and family with entry sensors, motion sensors, and glass break sensors. Soon you'll make your home a burglar's worst nightmare, and you'll be done in under an hour. SimpliSafe comes pre-programmed to work out of the box. Just plug in the base station, and it'll talk you through the whole process. Seriously, even someone who isn't the slightest bit handy, Abe.
Even me.
Even Abe, who literally, I'm not sure, can screw in a screw with a screwdriver, can install it. Abe is the least handy person since Norman Podhoretz, is all I'm going to say to you. The entire system is wireless, so there's no need to drill holes in your walls or do other permanent damage, which, by the way, also reminds me of the great Jackie Mason line about Jewish homes, which is that a Jew has something that's much better than a screwdriver. It's called a butter knife. And you always know when a screw is screwed in the wall because there's still some cream cheese stuck in it. Once you're all set up, SimpliSafe, I hope SimpliSafe doesn't mind the interruptions for Jackie Mason, makes it just as easy to stay protected month to month. And there are no long-term contracts, no hidden fees. It's just $14.99 a month for 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, professional monitoring and emergency dispatch service. Don't wait another day to take your home safety into your own hands. Get SimpliSafe. Go to simplisafe.com/ricochet. That's SimpliSafe.com/ricochet. Ricochet, of course, RICOCHET. I don't need to, really shouldn't have to explain that to the literate view listeners of the Commentary Magazine podcast, but it is a French word. It has a T at the end that you don't, you know, silent. right now to get 10% off your home security system. SimpliSafe.com/ricochet, spelled SimpliSafe.com. Go now, and thanks to Simply Safe. And now we move on to the other scandal of the week, which is the release of the really jaw-dropping book Shattered by Jonathan Allen and Amy Parnes, which is flying off the shelves, came out on Tuesday. Everybody who has read it that I know of, which includes me and Michiko Kakutani of the New York Times and three or four other people, it is maybe the most revelatory campaign book I've ever read, because it's called Inside, the subtitle is Inside Hillary Clinton's Doomed Campaign. And it makes it clear, I think, beyond any question, that had Hillary won, had Hillary actually won the 100,000 extra votes in the three states that she needed to win the presidency, her victory would have been fundamentally a mistake or a result of blind luck, because this woman who had no business losing to Donald Trump, as you know, given her history and the structural advantages of the Democratic Party and various other things.
And her opponent.
And her, that's what I mean. And her opponent ran maybe the worst political, given all of her advantages, money, a terrible opponent, with enormous negatives, and, you know, her extraordinary fame, ran the worst campaign in American history.
Now, before you get into this, I'm going to posit something to you from the perspective of a cynical Democrat who is tired of hearing how WikiLeaks invasions and Podesta's emails and Russian interference in the election and Jim Comey can be explained away just because Hillary Clinton didn't visit Wisconsin.
Well, I think it's very easy, because the book makes clear that the seeds of everything that went wrong with Hillary date back to a moment after the 2008 campaign, when she became obsessed with the question of who in her campaign, her 2008 campaign, had been leaking nasty stuff to the press about what was going on inside the campaign. And they launched a kind of email witch hunt in the campaign's caught to see who had emailed reporters and stuff like that. And that some of this may have been, and it makes logical sense, provided the trigger for her to set up the private email system that is the reason that she is not president today. I think it is totally fair to presume at this point, despite all of her weaknesses, that had there never been a private email system, Hillary Clinton would be president today. The thing that Trump had on her, that WikiLeaks had on her, that Comey had on her, that everybody had on her, all flowed from the creation of this email system in which she mishandled classified information. The very reason that we don't want and aren't supposed to allow for private email systems taking the place of government email systems is precisely to protect classified information. And that we had a culture, interestingly enough, even if you follow along the line that I'm now going to proffer to you, which is a culture of total fecklessness about security, led to John Podesta's emails being able to be retailed by Guccifer 2.0 to WikiLeaks. What did he do? John Podesta did something or other that exposed, clicked on a phishing email or something, that exposed the entirety of his, this is a guy who was White House Chief of Staff or Deputy White House Chief of Staff, was like the most important person in the Hillary campaign, a leading Democratic figure, and his emails were stolen by a foreign security service, it appears, some foreign intelligence service, through the modality of him being an idiot. Like when you get something, it says, da da da, click here. Like, you know, even Abe, a man who does not know how to screw in a screw. Well, I don't know, Abe, maybe you clicked on click here.
I've never clicked on, no.
See, even Abe didn't click on click here. I mean, just think about that.
Because my my inability with tools is only paralleled by my paranoia.
Right.
So I would never click on anything.
Right. So why didn't John Podesta do that? So I'm saying, so Hillary is like, we got to cover it. We got to have a thing where people can't see my emails. And John Podesta, even though it seems like the opposite thing, it's like, what's with these people? Now, what's missing from the book, I will say, and I wrote a column on this on Tuesday or Wednesday, which I couldn't get into with, is, you know, there's no analysis, because the book is not an analytical book, of why she set up the email system, right? Which is the great, and the entire thing is all through the 18 months of her campaign. People are like, why did she do it? Oh my God, why are we dealing with this? If only she hadn't done it. And Obama's like, why did she do it? And the Robbie Mooker, campaign managers, I can't believe she did it. And she did it for a reason. She didn't do it because she was just haphazard and stupid. She did it because there was information that she wanted to hide from exposure, you know, as a result of a Freedom of Information Act request. And we also know that she destroyed tens of thousands, 50,000 emails claiming that they were merely matters relating to her daughter's wedding, you know, maybe, which maybe they were, and maybe they involved the engagement of Luca Brasi to, you know, to go after Bruno Tattaglia. I mean, who knows? I mean, the whole point is that she did it because she wanted to hide stuff, and we don't know what she hid because she successfully destroyed it. And, you know, someone literally took a hammer to the server, right? It was in a dump in New Jersey, having been smashed with a hammer. So this is not the behavior of somebody who is just, you know, what an idiot. She set up a private email system, and, you know, that really, it's just so unfair that it all got exposed. Like,
But I have a question to follow up on Noah's. How does the book directly address the question of it was the Russian hackers, it was Comey? I mean, do Clinton campaign staff go on record saying that individually and anonymously that they don't think it was?
No. Everybody acknowledges that it was. Everybody acknowledges that it played some role. They don't know what role it is. Hillary, the interesting portrait of Hillary, who is not really a character in the book, oddly. I mean, she is, it's mostly about the people under her. But she's always angry. She's constantly angry. The speech draft is bad, and, you know, she's angry that the media is being unfair to her, and she calls in her, she, there are meetings where the staff is called in and yelled at because the media coverage is bad, or the speeches are bad, or this is not going well, or that's not going well. And the point that Alan and Parnas make through the book is, like, this all is the fish rotting from the head. Like, if the speeches are bad, it's because the speechwriters didn't know what to write for her. If the media coverage is bad, it's because she couldn't do anything to improve it because she didn't want to have interviews with people in which she would have to talk about the email scandal and try to address it. And yet she externalized all of this as though it was all just happening to her as a great cosmic injustice and an effort to prevent her from getting what it was that she would have wanted. And, you know, in the end, she concludes, there is this portrait of the election night where there she is, she's losing, and they're like, well, what do we do? And you remember this weird thing that night where it was like, where is she? Yeah. Why isn't she coming? You know, no one's at the Javits Center.
Yeah. Yeah. And there were a lot of stories too.
Yeah, well, and it's just, she basically said, I'm not ready.
Right.
I'm not ready to talk. And Obama calls her and says, you have to go concede for the good of the country. And she's like, I'm not ready to talk. And so Podesta goes to the stage of the Javits Center and says, they're still counting the votes, but we'll talk to you tomorrow morning. Like that, you know, because even at this moment where she was required somehow to find a gravity and a seriousness of purpose in herself, she was just governed by this sense that, you know, it was just so unfair. And of course, I think a lot of that really is her, some knowledge inside her that she did this all to herself.
But you know what's so amazing about that is that sense that it's unfair, that she is the sort of victim of forces beyond her control that repeatedly have it out for her, that was completely reinforced by her supporters. I mean, that was their line as well.
Well, it still is, to some extent, which is the comic part about the dead-end Hillary supporters, which is, you know, what happened when, having written a book about the decline and fall of the George H.W. Bush administration in 1993 called Hell of a Ride, I can tell you that when it was published in November of 1993, there were no defenders left of George H.W. Bush. It wasn't like people went, it's not fair, and this book is so nasty, and, you know, none of that. There was almost none of that. And Republicans knew that they were angry at Bush for having mishandled everything from basically the end of the Gulf War till the election of 1992, that he had bumbled and stumbled and didn't know why he was running and screwed everything up, and that he had handed the presidency to Clinton. And there are these Hillary people who are still apparently insistent on the notion that they are going to root out the evildoers who talked to Jonathan Allen and Amy Parnas and punish them. But who are, what, you know, Hillary World is going to take its revenge. Well, what the hell is Hillary World? Hillary World is like the court of the King of Albania after the communists have taken over. She is so gone. Clinton is so gone. They are so gone. You don't even know how gone they are. They are so gone that Tom Perez of the Democratic National Committee is like walking behind Bernie Sanders with his tongue hanging out of it. Bernie Sanders won't even say he's a Democrat, even having acknowledged his membership in the Democratic Party in order to be a presidential candidate. Sanders is back to saying, I'm not really a Democrat. So who is it that the Democratic National Committee is acting like is the future of the Democratic Party? A 75-year-old Jewish independent socialist. Bill Clinton was the guy who became president because he was more right-wing than any other Democrat had been in 20 years and was willing to put, you know, mental defectives to death and you know, and sign welfare reform and do this and do that. And Hillary Clinton was nothing. She was sort of conventional by the time she ran. She was a conventional left-wing Democrat. She's gone. Those people have no power anymore. Who are they? They're, you know.
There's Chelsea, who's right on the cover of every magazine you can imagine, being the myth is being made in front of us.
That's an astounding thing, because I feel like the only people who are interested in this are in the media and entertainment industry.
Oh, no, but
I think
there's a half of it. There is a lot of hate clicking going on.
Right.
That the Chelsea, the stuff, and we know that it's working because The Hill, the Capitol Hill newspaper, as a very funny tweeter named Neon Taster keeps pointing out, there are a giant number of stories being done by The Hill, 350 different stories in the last 3 months or something about Chelsea Clinton. They're only doing that because The Hill hired a clickbait specialist, an SEO manager, who apparently has learned that you put Chelsea Clinton in a tweet or a headline or a Facebook post and people will read it. But I'm convinced that 75% of that are people who just want to read it to get angry that Chelsea Clinton is getting attention.
Yeah, no, it's not just The Hill. It's all over the place.
She's on the cover of Variety. Yeah.
Yeah, and she's talking about her you know, experience in activism.
Yeah.
I don't want to get too far off the trail here with the future of the Democratic Party, but it's something I'm going to write on later, is that the brand problem that the party has that they refuse to acknowledge is sort of akin to what we're seeing in Britain, where they called a snap election now, where conservatives are pretty much in ensconced in power, and Labour is led by a guy named Jeremy Corbyn, who's a bitter socialist who has led the party into the ground. And by calling an election now, they're essentially going to drive a stake into the heart of Labour, which is good if you're a conservative. But it demonstrates the extent to which the new left, which is very socialist, very progressive, very antagonistic towards what it regards as third way style American centrism, which was exemplified by Bill Clinton and Tony Blair, who in 1995 set the party on a new direction by saying we're not going to be nationalists anymore. We're not going to nationalize things. That was the clause four of their party platform.
Yeah, not nationalists. They were not going to. They were not going to. They were going to believe in socialism, in private enterprise.
It was Clement Attlee's platform, and they disregarded it. And that was the new direction that the party was going to go in. And then Labor dominated politics over there for
11 years.
Similarly, Bill Clinton forged a third way. In American politics, he didn't really mean it, and until 1994, he wasn't forced to abide by it. But he did campaign in that fashion, and without Barack Obama, there doesn't seem to be any real appeal for a sort of aggressive left-wing democratic progressivism. And they're pursuing it now without a personality to advance it, and it feels like a project that's just going to explode on the launching pad.
Well, you know, one thing we didn't even think that we, in our pre-game show, we were going to talk about on the show, but we should talk about and then probably close out with, is this special election in Georgia in which a 30-year-old documentary filmmaker named John Ossoff raised, I think, maybe the largest amount of money ever raised in a House race for a special election to replace the now Health and Human Services Secretary Tom Price, raised $8.3 million and just came up 2 points short of reaching the 50% threshold in the state and being able to serve as the next congressman. Now there's going to be a runoff. So what was interesting about this race is that Ossoff raised this money because the Democratic Party and the liberals in the United States are so woke to the danger of Trump. They are really an extraordinarily potent political force.
Woke means, to those who are not familiar with this sort of thing, aware, very socially conscious and aware, outside observers would call it paranoid.
Yes.
But it's a, about it's a term the new of
power structure. Yeah, the new. So they have awakened. The big question now is, will they be able to organize the way the Tea Party organized in 2009 and 2010, and use it to storm the barricades of various congressional districts? Democrats need to win 24 seats in order to take the majority in the House. So. Ossoff straddled these barriers because I'm sure he's pretty much to the left of Hillary, maybe a little to the right of Sanders. But he didn't run, being in a district that is majority Republican, he didn't run as a big left winger, and he didn't even run as a big anti-Trumper, really, even though that's how he raised the money. He just ran as a new face and not a rubber stamp for Washington and various other things. There is a joke around about how everyone's calling it a moral victory, and at some point the Democrats actually have to, moral victory is just another way of saying loss, and at some point the Democrats have to win victories as opposed to moral victories. But it was still a very impressive showing. I mean, it's a Republican district that the Republican has gotten more than over 60% in the House races in every race, and he got almost 50%, 48%, and now the turnout in the final election between him and a Republican named Karen Handel, the question is, he can probably, if he keeps the pressure up, turn out everybody who voted for him the first time. The question is, can the Republicans turn out everybody who voted Republican in the second race, which seems to me to be a harder poll, because it's one thing to wait online for an hour in this kind of special, and then are you really going to, is now there's going to be Karen Handel, and you're going to have to like Karen Handel to vote for Karen Handel.
I don't know if Republicans would be stupid not to throw money at this race. And they think they will. But Karen Handel's a well-recognized name. I think she won based on name recognition. She was a former gubernatorial candidate, former Secretary of State. Everybody knows who she is.
Not well-liked, though, apparently.
Not especially well-loved, but I don't know if that's really going to matter. She too, kept her distance from Donald Trump over the course of this campaign, honestly, which is very interesting. But she's calling in the big guns now, and everybody's rallying the Republican troops. So as a measure of fealty to the Republican Party, this district seems relatively Republican. So I don't know if everybody's going to get too worried. I mean, Democrats would probably be foolish to pin their hats on it. It feels like
I don't think they're pinning
the Pennsylvania 12 special in 2010, where Republicans got really sad that they didn't win a Democratic district and then proceeded to win 63 House seats a few months later.
Right. Well, I don't know if it's – I don't know. I mean, who knows? And somebody in Georgia knows, and special elections are very weird things. I think that there's good news for everybody in this one sense, which is that Democrats really – it is a mistake for Republicans and conservatives to imagine that just because Democrats didn't win outright in this race and didn't win this Kansas seat that CIA Director Mike Pompeo vacated a couple of weeks ago, that the fact that liberals can turn out 3 million people in the streets for the Women's March and keep having – tens of thousands of people come out just to talk about Trump's taxes and raise this kind of money for special elections in the House. And, you know, this is a very potent, nascent thing that is going on in the Democratic Party. Whether it can be organized and whether they're going to be smart about it. In other words, like, it's one thing to say the thing that happened with the Tea Party, and maybe we can sort of end with this. The thing that happened with the Tea Party is there were a million possible things that the Tea Party could say. And there were a million ways in which the Tea Party was being attacked by liberals and the left and the mainstream media for being an extremist, this, that, other thing. The Tea Party fundamentally came to center on one theme and one theme only. Even though it was mostly about Obamacare, or Obamacare was the trigger, it was spending. $2 trillion in new spending, $2.5 trillion in new Obama spending. This is a fundamental new thing that is going on, piling on debt. Government is getting too big and it spends too much. That was the common unifying glue. If the common unifying glue of the Democrats in 2018 is going to be Trump is evil, I don't know that that's going to work.
And that's where they're headed. I mean, that's what all this talk about being the resistance is. I mean, that's
this is part of what I think the brand problem is that it's like the Arrested Development line where, you know, this is they're selling the frozen banana that won't kidnap your family and kill you. And what happens if the frozen banana you're used to doesn't kidnap your family and kill you?
Right.
You know, and that's all you've got to your brand. I mean, that's you're really firing off every ounce of ammunition you've got, and no powder's dry.
I mean, in the end, the question is, will Trump being evil and the possibility of impeaching Trump, is that the birtherism of the Democrats in this sense, which is that there's no question that birtherism helped Republicans in some fashion or other in terms of its in terms of keeping the heat on and keeping them coherent, even if most mainstream people said this is ridiculous. He's an American citizen. This is like clown territory. But nonetheless, it did something. It had a kind of underground organizing effect. So obviously that is the case with if we win, we can impeach Trump. But there's got to be something more substantive than we've got to stop this one terrible person from particularly if he's not, if he remains as questionably effective at politics as he has proved so far. They're going to have to have some meat on the bones. Otherwise, it is just the Hillary campaign all over again.
Right, and also the Tea Party was reacting to what continued to be an ongoing issue in the Obama administration, which is spending. If the resistance is simply tied to the election results,
yeah.
They are by definition sort of history. You know,
Obama's first 16 months were an extraordinarily febrile time for Democratic leftist legislation and behavior. There was the stimulus, there was Dodd-Frank, there was Obamacare, there was the second half of TARP and TALF, and there was the partial takeover of the automobile industry. All of that happened in 16 months, so that the notion of saying, whoa, buddy, slow down, fella, like, what are you, you're crazy, if we don't stop you, God knows what you're going to do next. Well, if Trump doesn't get anything done, the imperative of stopping Trump is not going to have the same teeth I mean, it may have it with enough people to raise hundreds of millions of dollars, but I'm not sure you're going to get voters to crawl on broken glass to the polls, in November 2018. Right?
Yeah, they're going to have to cite executive authority, executive orders, which is all that the president has been able to appeal to. I think it was Jonah Goldberg who had a good column about how he's become a foreign policy president in his first 4 months, which is something you usually do in your second term when the gears of change in Washington grind to a halt and you can't get anything done. Right. And also, you sign a few executive orders. But the extent of his ability to change the political dynamics in Washington and create some sort of a lasting legislative impact has come entirely as a result of the pen and the phone that Barack Obama appealed to. So how's that going to get you to vote against a sitting member of Congress?
Well, particularly if the courts do to Trump what the courts did to Obama. As Obama issued all these executive orders, and many of them, or the most controversial of them, were stayed by courts, which block the Dreamers thing, right. Various other things, and obviously this has happened with Trump's most important executive order.
Well, he hasn't even moved on Dreamers.
Right, but I'm saying the most important Trump executive order has been now twice stayed by the courts. So he's shown to his people that his heart is in the right place, but they're not the ones. That's why the Ossoff district is important, because it is the classic now American suburban district, and it only went 1% for Trump, a district that is, 20% or 15% seems to be 10 to 15% more Republican than Democratic. Trump only won by 1%, so that means that a lot of people voted for Hillary, a lot of Republicans voted for Hillary in November. And this district is the portrait of what these supposed purple districts could be for Democrats, but they are going to have to wise up and not be governed by their lunatics and come up with a theme, a nationalized theme, to win the election with. And Trump being a bad guy is an important part of it, but it's not a theme. Because, as we see, Hillary Clinton didn't win the presidency. And again, Democrats can generate tens of millions of more votes than Republicans in 2018. And as the map of the United States shows, this is not a national election, right? So she can generate 10 billion votes in California. But, 80% of the geographical territory of the United States is Trumpville, geographically, and that's what House districts, state by state, really depend upon. So anyway, we come to an end of our second podcast of the week. I hope you've enjoyed our perorations on sexual harassment and Shattered and other things. I'm John Podhoretz for Noah Rothman and Abe Greenwald. Keep the candle burning.